In 2003, when I retired here to Gloucester, I became very interested in the old West End Theater under the direction of Linda Robinson. At that time, Linda was putting together the production of the playwright Eve Ensler's The Vagina Monologues. So she cast me as a co-narrator and one of the vaginas. To be more specific, the angry vagina, which I actually thought was quite intuitive of on her part. The Vagina Monologues originated in 1996, and basically they put Eve Ensler on the map. They have been performed in 40 countries. They're still current. They have inspired a phenomenon called V-Day movement, which has raised $70 million towards anti-violence programs. Now, I learned a lot about the vagina in that experience. And coupled with a clinical rotation in OBGYN when I was in nursing college in the early 60s, that followed by the publication Our Bodies, Ourselves, put out by the Boston Feminist Coalition, I figured I had a pretty firm grasp on what I needed to know about the vagina until Dr. Armin Hillman arrived on the scene. I met Armin last summer, following having read one of his many books. The one I had finished was Original Sin. Armin has married several disciplines, including classical mythology, Greek, Latin, chemistry, pharmacology, bacteriology, and his research has inspired documentaries that are shown on the History Channel, and the London Times referenced Armin's work as the last wild happening in the classics. In this time of the Me Too movement, which essentially, my position is that paints women as victims. I suggest that Armin would do a collaboration with Eve Ensler and take the monologues to a new level, bringing the vagina back to the classics. I'm happy to introduce friend, a veritable scholar, Armin Hillman.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Thank you. I hope to be able to live up to the standard that you've set down. I wanted to just start by saying I don't want to waste anybody's time. I wanted to thank, and I did thank Mr. Farini outside for rearranging his schedule so that he could be here. It's very important to me. In Polis is this, the poet Hesiod is invoked as if the filmmaker was somehow a guardian of his tomb and was there to watch and keep it and perform some sort of necromantic rite to raise him from the dead. So I feel like I've come in the company of decent people, and I want to thank you for having me and allowing me to address you. It's funny that you introduced me the way you did, Susan, because my notes follow yours. I was going to mention the last wild frontier of classics, specifically because I want to bring you back an artifact from antiquity, and I want to bring back some of the one of the natives for you to see and to observe. That's the mission that I have right now. My name is Armin Hillman, David Charles Armin Hillman. I went to Special Projects, a CIA and military recruiting school that most of our students went to, one of the military academies or the CIA. I was recruited for West Point, was working with John McCain, volunteering, that is, for the sake of a assistance, for the sake of a nomination. And I say the name John McCain with due reverence because one of my ancestors was Harry Hansen in the 5th Cavalry, and this is the only thing personal I will say tonight that maybe will show you something about why I'm approaching the research the way that I am. Again, I don't want to waste your time. But Harry Hansen was with the 5th Cavalry, and to make a long story short, he guarded Geronimo on the prison train from Arizona to Florida. The only story that was passed on about this interaction to my family was that Geronimo was being treated like a dog. And Harry didn't like it, so he did the only thing he could do and shared his tobacco with him. That small act embodies the passion of the research that I do, and I hope that that will come across and you can see that. The reason I'm here, the real reason I'm here, you have to understand the path that I took, as Susan said, so bear with me, please. I dug at Telmegiddo after a bachelor's degree because I decided not to join the military, although I had the nomination. I decided that Latin, for some reason, and Greek were more important to me. Fortunately, after digging at Telmegiddo with the Chicago team, we were able to unearth a Canaanite floor, which was probably the most spectacular and awe-inspiring moment of my career. And the reason it's so awe-inspiring is not because it was an old object, but because it was a circular performance space for priestesses who wielded power and formed the basis of Western thought. I lived in the Jezreel Valley at the palace of Jezebel and Ahab, and in the morning I would watch the sunrise over the vineyard of Naboth, a man who came to an awful end. After the time that I spent in Megiddo, I decided that my Latin and my Greek were growing strong and I could access the text, but what I really needed to do was to look at the science, because the science called me like a muse because of its structure and organization and pure mathematics. So I joined an animal sciences lab, and I taught and worked in a neuroendocrinology research project where we were trying to isolate and identify AGD, anti-gonadotropic decapeptide. The applications of this were, it may have helped to stop, if we could isolate it, find where it was, and what cascade of was happening between the hypothalamus and the pituitary, what chemical cascades, neurochemical cascades were happening, we might be able to stop premature puberty. My job was to assist in hypophyseal portal cannulation, process whereby you drill into a brain, into the third ventricle, which is the well of the brain. It literally is a well that holds the fluid that bathes everything that causes us to think. We would add chemicals to it and then see what those chemicals did. I would collect the brains and slice them, microtome, use osmium tetroxide, one of the most toxic substances known to man, to stain those cells. I had to take an entire class just to be certified to use the osmium. At this time, Dr. Frank Romer from the classics department approached me and said, "How's the brain cutting going?" I said, "It's going well." He's a classicist. And he said, "Look, Mr. Hillman, I know that you set yourself a foundation in classics and now you're over here in the sciences. There's a bridge between the two and it's ancient medicine." He explained to me that we have hundreds and hundreds of pages of untranslated texts in both Greek and Latin. To me, that sounds incredible. And I asked them, why are these untranslated? Well, because it's technical and it's difficult to understand. You may have a window into that area. So to make a long story short, I followed that path, and I went to the University of Wisconsin with Dr. John Scarborough, who was himself a medically trained professor. And what I found was a world, and that's why I say frontier, that I had never seen, and a world that I hadn't seen published in secondary form. There were no secondary texts that talked about this world, this frontier that I was seeing. So when I presented it at conferences, that's why the Times said that, because they were present and realized that the frontier was being exposed. I'm very happy to do it. But in the process, I wrote my dissertation on Roman pharmacy and was told that I wouldn't be passed if I did not remove. It was an entire dissertation on Roman pharmacy in general. And I was told to remove the chapter on recreational drugs and any references to recreational drugs throughout the text in order to get my degree. After having read all this material, I was flabbergasted. So I went ahead and redacted the text, published it took the material and then published it with St. Martin's in the book, The Chemical Muse. Of course, this got me a black eye. And I was, it was in the press, and the university didn't come out looking positively, but the reaction was for me to be somewhat blacklisted. The comment that I was given by the head of the department of the dissertation was, they just wouldn't do such a thing. I asked her about all of the texts and about all of the medicine that I had read and all the pharmaceutical texts. There are literally, Galen alone has more untranslated texts than Homer, Virgil, Aristotle, Plato, Ovid, Catullus, combined. Untranslated. So I asked myself, if they just wouldn't do such a thing, what are these things that they wouldn't do? And this will bring you to the sources, the fountains of the information. And I know this, stay with me, because I'm about to get to the vaginas. I enjoy reading and researching the sources that aren't typically acceptable sources due to the content. Because once I was told you can't publish an idea because they just wouldn't do that, I took it up as my quest to publish about those things in order to force people to look at them, in order to create a picture of the ancient world that didn't have a lens between us and it, to see it through their eyes. And the only way to do that is to take you back to the actual people themselves. And so that's what I'd like to attempt to do, and I'd like to start that with an artifact. I'd like to introduce you to an artifact from antiquity. It's called the alabastron, and it is a medical applicator that is shaped like a penis and was used by priestesses to apply compound drug prescriptions that they had researched in the course of women's health. These priestesses developed a system of pharmacology that I describe as polyvalent. The idea is, you take a drug or a group of drugs derived from plants or animal sources, and you mix these drugs inside a human body. The human body then processes the drugs, and you derive a secondary set of drugs which can then be administered to patients or initiates. there's no, let me step back and remind you that there is no clear distinction in antiquity between medicine and religion and science, what we call science. There is no distinction. Medicine, religion, cult performance, pharmacology, these are all a single entity in the ancient world. And the alabastron, or as Sir Richard Burton called it, the leathern prick that was anointed with medicines and then applied in order to not only elicit and improve health, but also to create enlightenment. Now, there's one problem. There's only one type of body that can take this process, that has the capacity to do this, to transform. Oh, the other one has some capacities, and I found it in the physicians. But the female body is very peculiar to the ancients. Again, I'm trying to talk to you as if I could summon their ghosts. They were also necromancers and got a bad rap and ended up many of them getting flayed or killed. If I can step back and say one comment off script, you women in the group, if I can isolate you for a moment just to address you, you don't know what you're sitting on. From the things that I've seen a genius woman create antidotes for snake venoms by injecting those. And when I say inject, they didn't have injection technology, but they made cuts, ritual. During ritual operations, they made cuts in their arms and they used whips, and then they would cover the body, the wounded sections of the body, with the drugs, which is a very effective means. But what's more effective than the transmission is the use of the brilliant alabastron, the medical dildo. The female body is unique. I used to teach human repro at the University of Arizona, just as a grad and a student. And in the process of learning about how the brain works, you realize that there's this thing called neuroendocrinology. And all that means is, it's a fancy way of saying the brain's way of regulating your body. It's the control of your body. And in these control pathways, these chemical pathways that cascade in your brain and that cause neurons to act or unact, to silence them, these chemicals are the control mechanisms of you, of your person. But in the female, they are creative. Let me give you an example. Viper venom was used by the echidna priesthood. Echidna is a viper. It's the Greek word for viper. And the echidna priesthood would vaginally apply eos venom in order to create the eos mystery. These are priestesses. And in the eos mystery, the priestesses would develop an immunity to the viper venom and the capacity to administer breast milk that acted as an antidote to the viper venom. As a biochemist, that is sheer genius. And that was developed by the feminine mind and the feminine body. That's what's being hidden from you, not intentionally, perhaps out of ignorance and willful ignorance. But that's what's being hidden from you. Now I want to tell you about one of the pioneers that pushed the process of creating chemicals that would respond to the human body or to the female body in a way that would facilitate religious activity. Because remember, you don't go to a hospital and sit in a bed. You go to a temple where you're treated by professionals who grow their own and harvest their own venoms, toxins, poisons, and they're using everything. The stories I could tell you, from scorpion and spider venom to every snake known to them, to beaver perianal glands. They would harvest the perianal gland of European beavers, process it, and create an antidote, a treatment for headache. It turns out the beavers were eating willow bark, and basically they were, the Roman, Greek and Roman physicians were creating aspirin. That knowledge, that pool of knowledge, comes from a feminine source that is tagged with the fingerprint of the feminine body. None of this can be done without the uterus. None of this can be done without the ovaries. And the funny thing is, when you get down to these texts and you pull out what these authors are doing and what the poets are talking about, that the priestesses are doing in their rituals, when you pull out these chemicals, you can see the fingerprint of the feminine reproductive system, both in the cult and in the medicine that's functioning within the cult. What's the time period that we're talking about? Late Bronze Age. You all think that Hippocrates was the father of medicine, right? Hippocrates was born 600 years after the true founder of Western medicine, whose name was Medea. And immediately most of you poets will think, Medea is a fictional character. No, Medea was an historical queen who was so popular that an entire ethnic group changed their identity to be called Medes in order to honor her. She was the inventor of a weapon called naphtha. The Greeks used it in their military, in their navy, to burn ships. She used it in medicine to perform what they called breathing the fire, which apparently nobody could do but her, because the medicine was specific to the specific body. Not anybody can do this. It requires a unique individual. Alexander the Great used Medea's fire on an actor just to see if it worked. They put this poor, they took the fire and they put it all over his face and shoulders. And unfortunately, he got too close to a flame and he was burned very badly. You don't have to, because it produces its own fumes, you don't have to have the flame directly on the medicine. You just have to have it near it. And the process of bringing the flame is called calling down the flame from Uranus, from heaven, which is a terrible translation, but from the vault. And you may have heard this expression in a slightly different way if you've looked at what we call the Old Testament, because another famous woman, Jezebel, was involved in a contest with the prophets of Jehovah. Jehovah's prophets managed to call down the fire, and Jezebel's prophets were all murdered. What we think is miraculous, what we have historically, is genius. What else did Medea do? And why should she be given the ability to rise here? I think perhaps the most important act that she performed for the sake of the flow of history was to create a form of religion in which the woman's voice was put side by side with the woman's body. Yes, she colonized places all over the place. She's in Italy. They worshipped her in Italy as Angitia. They built a temple to her. That's a fancy way of saying they set up a hospital. Because when she arrived, one of the locals had been bitten by one of the marsh snakes. He was a Martian. And she gave him an antidote and healed him. Whereas up until that time, apparently, most of the people had been dying from these marsh snakes. So they created a kingdom for her. They put her on a pedestal. She did this throughout the ancient world. She was in Corinth. You think she killed her children? There are ancient sources that say, no, the Corinthians killed her sons. And then suffered a plague, sent an ambassador to the oracle at Dodona, I believe it was Dodona, and asked, what do we do? And they said, build us some sort of monument to Medea's sons and set the record straight, and the plague will go away. You can track her movements all over the Mediterranean. But I think what I'll do is I'll save her additional accomplishments, and there are many, for questions afterwards, and I'll proceed with how are we doing on time? Are we good? Okay. Does anybody have any pressing questions at this point? I just want to make sure that we're all following the same train. Is it clear what I'm studying and how I'm doing that? The tools that I'm using to do that, the language and the science. Is that clear?
I'm curious about all you were talking about Galen and all this untranslated stuff.
Yes.
And was much of what your findings in there?
Yes. Galen is a huge source. As a matter of fact, he wrote a book called On Antidotes. It's page after page of the most interesting material known to humanity that explains to us concepts like the small pills that were used and made and stamped that carried the Eos mystery, or that carried the combos, the combination drugs that had to be employed by these physicians. And these drugs are absolutely crazy. They're absolutely wonderful. But let me, Galen is a big one. The other ones are Nicander. A lot of these people are unread. Dioscorides. Has anybody heard of Dioscorides? Nobody's heard of these, right? Scribonius Largus, another physician. He says, hey, you can get fresh liver at the arena, right, for ingredients. That's the best place to get human liver, is at the arena. Yes? Okay, so Galen is the personal body physician of the Emperor Marcus Aurelius. So we're talking 2nd century A.D., roughly 180, 185. He's really active. And Galen made a mark for himself by performing a dissection on a pig, a living dissection in which he cut, ligated the recurrent laryngeal nerve, which gives you the ability to vocalize. He ligated this in the pig in front of everyone. The pig stopped squealing. And then he undid the ligature, and the pig started squealing. And humanity discovered what nerves do. This is the world that they're living in. This is what we have in the text. And this is what we don't focus on. And that's what I want to get to now. Why is it that this art that was created by women for women, that put women on a platform, a power platform, where they could give orders to communities that would follow them, oracles, who would give you, oh, we have an emperor, we have a tyrant, what do? We have a tyrant who is concentrating all the wealth in the hands of a few, and what do we do? These are actual oracles. What do we do? And the oracular response is, much more poetically, he's got to die. And so they would. They would kill them based on the order of the oracle, who has a religious authority that stems back to the operation of women's health. It's a very strange pairing that government and women's health can work in unison.
Really?
But they do. Now, I wanted to make sure that I didn't leave you with any misconception about the difficulty of the research. Not because it's difficult to look up, but because it's difficult to publish. Because these topics are taboo. It's very difficult to talk about sexual activity in humanities/classics environments. It's difficult to talk about erections. It's difficult to talk about orgasms. It's difficult to talk about administering drugs via the anus in rituals in which men are tied down, drugged, and the reason they're tied is because they're given psychotics, drugs that induce psychosis, in order to achieve enlightenment via the communion with the goddess's fluid. In order to get to this place, you have to have some advanced chemistry. The women of antiquity were not oppressed. They were not shut out of society. They were the builders of society. Feminism should have recognized that the problem is not women who were held down. But an attempt to destroy the very wisdom that had been produced through the feminine body. And that's where we get to the mystery. I promised Richard and Carl that I would not scare you tonight. You laugh now. How can this be applied to us today? How is this relevant to us today? Mary Magdalene had her own alabastron. She used it on Jesus, according to the New Testament. And according to Nonus, a source you've never heard of, but is out there, Mary Magdalene wiped Jesus' semen from his body with her hair after applying the alabastron to him. I am curious as to the textual problems we have in translating the Bible in any Greek or Latin, and why it is that we have a difficulty answering basic questions of language. Basic questions of language. Why does the text, I'll give you one question. Why does the text of Mark, chapter 14, verses 51 and 52, why does it tell us that Jesus was arrested in a public park at 2 a.m. with a naked boy? When I read that, I wanted to find out why. I'm going to say that one more time. Jesus was arrested in a public park at 2 a.m. with a naked boy. You should start to be offended at some point, unless I've misjudged you, and that you have some special defense of the poetry that you consult and the dead spirits of the poets that you resurrect, which is your duty to do. And somehow you have an immunity to this. Does anybody offended in the least that I just said Jesus was arrested in a public park at 2 a.m. with a naked boy? Don't answer that.
It's a tough group.
Right. It's Mark 14, 51 and 52. And if you're curious about it, it says twice in the Greek that he was naked. And it identifies the boy's age. He's a Neonisko, so I would put him at the younger end of 11, 12, 13. You could argue that he was a little bit older. However, in all the ritual texts where they talk about the Neoniska, she's usually a pallas. And we know that the pallas, that's another Greek word, that transferred itself into Latin as pilex. We know that that age group is prepubertal. And we know that they were using these prepubertal priestesses to produce anti-venom. Because everybody understands the genius of what she did, right? When she takes the venom internally, she gets it into her bloodstream, she develops antibodies, which are then excreted in her breast milk. But the problem is, how do you get a prepubertal girl who's never been pregnant, can't be pregnant, to breastfeed? It's chemically, physically, genetically, well, it's not impossible. No, it actually turns out it's not. How did they do it? Because the viper venoms act on the same receptors as the hormones, specifically prolactin. They were inducing nursing of virgins. That's genius. So what does that have to do with this? I'm going to open this in 1 second for the final scare. This is the final scare of the evening. But what does that have to do with the Bible? And what does it have to do with the New Testament? And what does it have to do with Jesus arrested in a public park? And what does it have to do with the Christians of the late 1st, 2nd, and 3rd centuries who were being prosecuted by Roman officials for rounding up orphan boys and performing rituals in which they stripped them naked, oiled them up, offered them the temptation of Lucifer, to which the boys would scream out, "No! Away!" And then had to be counseled following the process, because it was very difficult on them emotionally, by the priests. We have this in the text. They talk about this. These sexual practices are not separable from the cult, from the mystery cults. And Christianity is a mystery cult. The first person who tried to stop this was Paul the Apostle, who said, "Stop taking the poisons." Rebaptizing people who have been baptized by John the Baptist himself. Because they were drinking the cup of idolatry. Was Jesus right when he said you'll be able to drink the venoms and not suffer ill? What was in the cup that was offered to him? Why does Dracontius tell us in Latin, Nonus in Greek, in the paraphrase of the Gospel of John, tells us that the cup contained an antidote to the dipsas. That's a viper. That's a name for a viper that lives in North Africa. specifically in Libya. The priestesses there, I'm not joking, it sounds crazy. The priestesses in Cyrene use the venom in their Eos mystery rites and sold it on the in the Roman marketplace. They actually shipped it to Rome. And you could buy it in Rome. Lucan tells us that. You can buy this stuff in Rome. Paul is trying to stop it. So let's get to the big surprise. The book of the Apocalypse by Saint John is a book about a war between the forces of God and his Lamb and the forces of Lady Mystery. I'm translating directly for you. Lady Mystery. And what was the charge against Lady Mystery? Why was she held in such contempt by God and his Lamb? Because she had offered the cup of her own sexual juice. She had offered, you may have heard of it, poorly translated into English, as the cup of her idolatries or the cup of her fornication. Lady Mystery is brought forth by the beast. Remember, she's carried by the beast. The Greek word there is theion. It happens to be the very same word that the physicians used to describe their beast, the beast that brings the vision of the Lady of Mystery. They called this the theriac, a drug specifically meant to convey mystery, to convey enlightenment. And the beast, the drug, would carry Lady Mystery against the forces of God and his Lamb and would be beaten because they would be thrown into the lake of fire along with the dragon. By the way, just to release some drama, the dragons and the wolves are groups of priests who protect oracles. The Romans used priestesses called the lupi. It's also the word for prostitute. The wolf that feeds, that breastfeeds the prince. Did you see, they recognized it. They knew the power lay behind her. It lay behind her milk, her nourishment. They wove it into their myth. And what's the pill that I should have given you at the beginning of the talk that I didn't? It's the words of John Lytus. All you need to know is he was a Roman writing in Greek, and he wrote about the Etruscan religion that preceded the Roman religion. And he said the Etruscan priestesses, the Wates, who practiced their art on the Vatican Hill, worshiping Vaticanus 1,000 years before Christianity, that these priestesses said, we must convey to you transdimensional ideas that can only exist in metaphor and allegory. That's what myth is. The priestesses says, don't get confused. The stories are not stories. They are ritual. They are formulae. They are the mystery. You can see both in Italy and in Greece and in the Black Sea the things that they're creating. The theriac is the foundation for the very battle in the history of the Western world's religions. It's a battle between a feminine genius and a masculine something. John the Baptist, I mentioned before, and I'll wrap up. We'll get to questions. John the Baptist was known to dress in his girdle. If you read the pagan sources, they're very clear that the Baptists were big on dressing in women's clothing, carrying penis-shaped cups that were made of glass. They called it the vitreo priapeo. That was an ablative case, by the way. I should have put it in the nominative. That was for you. They would carry the glass penis, they would wear women's clothing, and they would take the boys, and not just any clothing, they wore the clothing that was sexual, the girdle. They wore the thing that was supposed to attract the attention to the pudenda, the girdle of Aphrodite. John is wearing it, and he's taking boys out into the wilderness. And I said, it didn't even enter my mind. I didn't even enter my mind that this would have a reason or a purpose, that he would initiate them in the wilderness, baptize them, and that this would have some purpose. It seemed like just. But they discovered there's one more source of antidote for the venoms that they were using. And it only comes, in the text at least, it only comes from a prepubertal boy through his semen. And I'm sure it has something to do with the hormones. I'm sure it has something to do with the fact that his testosterone level is down here and that he's more feminine, perhaps. So John lost his head because he converted the rite from the girls to the boy. Why was Jesus arrested in a public park at 2 a.m. with a naked boy? Because he was performing the mystery of the kingdom of heaven. Thank you for having me, and I'll give you questions. I'll open it up for questions. Thank you.